Shakespeare wrote Troilus and Cressida about 1602. He had written Romeo and Juliet about 7 years earlier. But I have put these two plays together, back to back, in the series of lectures, because they make a good pair. Both are love tragedies. Both tell the stories of young lovers conducting a secret affair who are broken apart by the hostile society that surrounds them. It is the same kind of setup, but they're quite different in their tone, quite different in their final result. With Troilus and Cressida, in fact, we have two stories. And they are very ancient stories, much older than the story of Romeo and Juliet. The story of the Trojan War itself, of course, goes back to Homer, putting together the Iliad somewhere in the 8th century BC. Shakespeare had some acquaintance with Homer. He also knew Virgil's contribution to the story in the Aeneid, and Ovid's contribution, and many medieval versions of the same. The story of Troy had been written up in earlier British writing by Lydgate, the medieval poet, and in late medieval times, Caxton, the first English printer, built a press in London, printed books for the Yorkist kings, for Edward IV and Richard III, amongst which was a large collection of the tales of Troy. And in Shakespeare's own time, his slightly younger contemporary, the poet and playwright George Chapman, was translating Homer's Iliad directly into English. It is an old story, many times retold. But the love story is not part of the original Homeric material. Troilus and Cressida and Pandarus are names that do occur in Homer's poem, but they are not linked in a love story. Diomedes also occurs in Homer, and he's a major Greek hero, but he is not linked with any of the other three I have mentioned. The story that ties them all into a love affair was invented in the Middle Ages by a French writer called Benoît de Saint-Maur. It was then worked into a Latin prose account by an Italian, Guido del Colone, developed into a long Italian poem by Boccaccio, and finally reached Britain in a very great poem by Geoffrey Chaucer, Troilus and Cressida. Chaucer ends his poem with the parting of the lovers and the death of Troilus. A later British poet, Henryson, completed the story of Cressida with a book called The Testament of Cressida. So we have two stories here that have been of different origins. A primitive, heroic story coming from the ancient Greeks, and a medieval, chivalric story of courtly love and knightly distinction. There are resemblances between them. Both the primitive heroic society and the chivalric medieval society value honor. They make sense. It makes sense to have the one story grow out of the other. But it makes a great deal for Shakespeare to deal with in a very busy play. The most important thing that Shakespeare does with this collection, with this material, is to make it ugly. He takes this august heritage and turns it into a harsh play of love that is mingled with infatuation and calculation. Love that leads to betrayal, bitterness, and savagery. The disrespectful, the satiric tone appears right at the beginning in the prologue. And to make that point, I want to compare the prologue of Troilus and Cressida to the prologue of Romeo and Juliet. Each has a choral figure come on and introduce the play. This is the way the chorus of Romeo and Juliet starts. Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene, from ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life, whose misadventured, piteous overthrows doth with their death bury their parents' strife. The fearful passage of their death-marked love and the continuance of their parents' rage, which but their children's end naught could remove, is now the 2 hours' traffic of our stage. The which, if you with patient ears attend, what here shall miss, our toil shall strive to mend. It is a very sympathetic opening. It is the characters are presented as being, as commanding our concern. They are star-crossed lovers. Their fall is a piteous overthrow. Their lives are a fearful passage. Our sympathy is invited. And the chorus is very respectful to us in the audience. It asks for us to listen with patient ears. And it says, if we do anything wrong on this stage, what here shall miss, we'll try to amend it. Just tell us what we did wrong, and we'll make it better in the next performance. That is Shakespeare's usual polite, ingratiating manner toward the audience. He solicits their attention toward a subject that he hopes they will be interested in. The prologue to Troilus and Cressida is quite different. In Troy, there lies the scene. From isles of Greece, the princes Orgulous, their high blood chafed, have to the port of Athens sent their ships fraught with the ministers and instruments of cruel war. This is very high-flown language indeed, very pompous. The princes Orgulous. Orgulous means proud, but it was an archaic word even in Shakespeare's time. 69 that wore their crownets regal from the Athenian bay put forth toward Phrygia, and their vow is made to ransack Troy, within whose strong immures the ravished Helen, Menelaus' queen, with wanton Paris sleeps. And that's the quarrel. Now, it's that note of flippancy that I wanted to catch. We begin with the high-flown terms, the princes Orgulous and their crownets regal and their long journey across toward Phrygia, and they're going to ransack Troy. And then in the 10th line, the diction changes. Menelaus' queen with wanton Paris sleeps. It's about this woman who is an adulterer and she's sleeping with a pretty boy. And that's the quarrel. That's what it's all about, a couple of commonplace adulterers. The prologue goes on for another 20 lines and has the same kind of effect. He builds up great excitement. He even lists the 6 gates of Troy, Dardan and Timbria, Hellas, Chetus, Troian, and Antinorides with massy staples and corresponsive and fulfilling bolts. And he gets all our expectation excited. In fact, he talks about expectation on either side of the war. Both the Trojans and the Greeks are eager for combat. And then he finishes off this way. Our play leaps o'er the vaunt and firstlings of these broils, beginning in the middle. Now, that's quite appropriate for an epic. It begins in medias res. I'm doing the epic thing. This is going to be grand. Starting thence away to what may be digested in a play. Like or find fault, do as your pleasures are. Now, good or bad, 'tis but the chance of war. I don't care whether you like it or hate it. It's a chance of war. It's the only time Shakespeare is ever flippant with an audience, rude to an audience, condescending to an audience. You take it if you like it. I don't care. That's a warning of what we're up against in this play. The story has idealism to it, on the one hand, and baseness on the other. Very frequently, the characters speak of noble and lofty things, and then they do something utterly opposite. Ulysses, the wisest and craftiest of the Greek heroes, has one of the most famous speeches in Elizabethan drama. There's a great gathering together of the Greek captains in the first act. The captains have been fighting for many years. They wonder why the war is going so badly. They can't seem to get on. Achilles has refused to join them. He's sulking in his tent. And Ulysses endeavors to explain to the other commanders, Agamemnon, Nestor, and the rest, that a fundamental problem is the lack of proper hierarchy in the Greek camp. The whole world is organized in a universal vertical order, and that isn't being followed here. The speciality of rule hath been neglected. And look how many Grecian tents do stand hollow upon the plains, so many hollow factions. When that the general is not like the hive, to whom the foragers shall all repair, what honey is expected? An army ought to be organized like a hive, everybody reporting back to the center, to the hive, obedient to the orders of the queen, following out what they are supposed to do, depending on whether they are workers or drones or whatever. The thing that keeps a hive together or the world together is degree. I continue with Ulysses. Degree being visited, that is, masked, the unworthiest shows as fairly in the mask. The heavens themselves, the planets, and this center observe degree, priority, and place, insisture, form, proportion, season, form, office, and custom, all in line of order. Take but degree away, untune that string, and hark what discord follows. Each thing meets in mere oppugnancy. If you don't have proper degree, everything fights each other. Everything is at war with everything else. And to quote one bit more, then everything includes itself in power. Power into will, will into appetite, and appetite an universal wolf, so doubly seconded with will and power, must make perforce an universal prey and last eat up himself. If we don't have degree and proper order, we will devour ourselves. We will destroy ourselves. This is absolute Elizabethan orthodoxy. This speech, in fact, has been removed from context and placed in a book called The Elizabethan World Picture, in which a Shakespearean critic named Tilliard explained to the 20th century what he felt all Elizabethans believed. It is a first-class political speech. The only thing wrong with it is that Ulysses hasn't in the least any intention of observing degree himself. The problem with the Greeks, he knows perfectly well, is that Achilles, their best fighter, is sulking in his tent, won't join in the war. And what he actually proposes at the very end of this scene, in a private conversation with Nestor, when all the other captains have left, is not that Achilles be brought back into his proper place in the hierarchy of degrees, but that Achilles be made jealous. Let's set up Ajax and acclaim him as a great hero. Make a lottery and by device let blockish Ajax draw the sort to fight with Hector. Let's pretend to have an open lottery, and we'll have the stupidest man amongst us, Ajax, cried up as the great hero. Ajax employed plucks down Achilles' plumes. That is, Ulysses' plan really is not to decrease the amount of disorder and emulation amongst the Greeks. It is to increase it, and thus get Achilles back to the battle so that they can win the war. Ulysses does more of this in the middle of the play. That part was at the beginning. In the middle, he works directly upon Achilles, trying to persuade Achilles that he must fight again. And his means of doing so is to tell him, well, this is what he tells him. No man is the lord of anything, though in and of himself there be much consisting, till he communicate his parts to others. That is, you don't have your virtues, your strengths, your abilities, until you make them active in the world, until you communicate your parts to others. Now, that is standard Shakespearean assumption about human behavior. It is standard Elizabethan assumption about human behavior. I've talked about it before in this series of lectures. It is, in fact, originally a Christian doctrine. It is the parable of the talents from the Gospel of Matthew, that our talents are not our own exclusively to hoard. We must put them out into the world so that they benefit others. Only then are they truly virtuous. I talked about this when I was talking about Twelfth Night, about Shakespearean comedy. It is a standard Shakespearean test of character. But Ulysses takes this noble and lofty doctrine and turns it into a very vulgar point about publicity. Not that you must use your talents, but that you must make sure that everybody knows about your talents. No man is the lord of anything, though in and of himself there be much consisting, till he communicate his parts to others, nor doth he of himself know them for aught, till he behold them formed in the applause whereto they're extended, who like an arch reverberate the voice again. Time hath, my lord, a wallet at its back, wherein he puts alms for oblivion, a great-sized monster of ingratitude. Those scraps are good deeds past, which are devoured as fast as they are made, forgot as soon as done. Unless you keep on doing good things, everybody's going to forget that you ever did any at all. Perseverance, dear my lord, keeps honor bright. Time is like a fashionable host, which eagerly greets the new guest, but lets the old ones go by. That is a very powerful speech. In fact, I've only quoted a small bit of it. It takes 50 lines to deliver it. And I always wondered, when I first read the play in school, how on earth do you play a 50-line speech with only two guys on the stage? One guy has to stand there and talk for 50 lines, and the other is supposed to just listen. How is that going to hold our attention on the stage? And I wondered that until I saw a perfectly wonderful production of Troilus and Cressida at the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford. And I discovered a great principle about these long speeches in Shakespeare. You don't pay attention to the guy who is speaking. You don't look at him, that is. You can attend to him merely by hearing him. And in this scene, in this particular production, the Ulysses, in fact, sat down on a kind of ancient Greek beach chair and delivered the whole speech from a seated posture, just with excellent diction. What we looked at was Achilles responding to it. And Achilles, who was a very handsome young man and dressed in almost nothing at all, was doing his exercises, swinging a weight around, looking at his own muscles. Hey, do you like that bicep? I worked hard for that. That thigh is pretty good, isn't it? And it's really difficult to get the calves properly pumped up. And the sheen, the oil I've run into, it was the most narcissistic thing I have ever seen on a stage. And to watch him respond as Ulysses went on hammering at him, "Nobody pays attention to you anymore, Achilles. They've forgotten what you did in the battles, Achilles. You like yourself, don't you, Achilles? But no one else is paying any attention." And Achilles got angrier and angrier and angrier, and finally he exploded. "What? Are my deeds forgot?" That's how Ulysses hooks a guy. Never mind about degree and order. Just work on them emotionally. Ulysses' schemes, in fact, have no effect. I mean, they have an immediate effect. He gets Nestor in his plan to jack up Ajax. He gets Achilles angry. But in fact, Achilles does not go back to the war because of anything that Ulysses does. Another of the great ironies in Troilus and Cressida is that the superbly crafty, extraordinarily eloquent man who can persuade you of anything momentarily, in fact, has no lasting effect on the progress of the war. Achilles goes back to the battle in Act 5. Nothing happens in the war for the first four and a half acts of this play. Achilles goes back into the battle because his dear friend Patroclus is killed. And that leads us to another place where something that is noble and august in Homer and in subsequent treatments of the Trojan story gets undermined. It is one of the great things in the Iliad, the friendship between Achilles and Patroclus. They are utterly devoted to each other. And when Achilles withdraws from the war because he feels insulted by Agamemnon, Patroclus withdraws with him and looks after him and tries to soothe him. But Patroclus is a highly sympathetic character, sympathetic to everyone in Homer. And he's very worried about the Greeks. And there comes a point when the Trojans are so successful that they're actually besieging the Greek ships and setting one or two of them on fire. The Greeks are about to lose this war. And Patroclus says to Achilles, well, if you won't go forth and save our own people, at least let me go forth. Let me put on your armor so that it will look like Achilles has come back to the war, and I will try to save the ships. Well, Patroclus is successful in doing that. He breaks the siege of the Greek ships. In fact, he is so successful that he carries the Greek army all the way across the plains of Troy, right up to the gates of the city itself. And there he is killed by Hector. And that, in the Iliad, is what brings Achilles back to the war. The death of Patroclus. He is so angry at the loss of his friend. That heroic friendship is the central relationship of Homer's poem, which Homer wrote, as I mentioned, somewhere around the 8th century BC, or at least compiled. It became an even more important relationship for later Greeks. The Greeks of classical times, the 5th and 4th century, commonly saw the relationship not only one of heroic and devoted friendship, but also of romantic and sexual love. They interpreted Patroclus and Achilles as lovers. Aeschylus wrote a play about it called The Myrmidons. The text of the play does not survive, but enough quotations from it do survive in other writers so that we know that it was a thoroughgoing relationship. For the Greeks of the classical period, a homosexual relationship could be productive of great and heroic behavior. Well, in Shakespeare's version, Shakespeare picks up that sexual tie and proceeds to have it debased, to make it a thing of utter squalor. He brings on Thersites, the Greek character who has nothing good to say about anybody, and has him denigrate the relationship between Achilles and Patroclus. He has Thersites call Patroclus Achilles' male varlet. And when Patroclus says, male varlet? What's male varlet? Why, his masculine whore! God save us from these preposterous discoveries. Treating the relationship as one of sexual opportunism and convenience, a mere kind of whoredom. In Thersites' opinion, in fact, everything going on is war and lechery. He describes at one point the whole war as nothing but an affair of a whore and a cuckold. Here is such patchery, such juggling, such knavery. All the argument is a whore and a cuckold, and a good quarrel to draw emulous factions and bleed to death upon. Now the dry serpigo on the subject, and war and lechery confound them all. Thersites' voice is a kind of running chorus going through the whole play, saying these people are total idiots. Agamemnon has no more brains than earwax. Ajax is a total fool. Ulysses is a dog fox. Patroclus is a male varlet. None of them is worth anything, and they're fighting for a whore. And that brings me to what they are fighting for. Helen. Helen of Troy. The cause of the war. The most famous woman in Greek legend. The most famous woman in classical antiquity. Now, I would suggest to you that in any play, movie, performance of any kind having to do with Troy, we all want to see Helen. It's one of the big things that we came to see. We came to see how they're going to manage the most beautiful woman of all antiquity. Expectation, that thing mentioned in the prologue of the play. Expectation is very high in the audience. How are they going to do Helen on the stage of the Globe this afternoon? And Shakespeare makes us wait through Act One, through Act Two, through the first part of Act Three. She doesn't come on until the middle of Act Three. Then we are supposed to see what Shakespeare's slightly older contemporary, Christopher Marlowe, called the face that launched a thousand ships. Again, let me make a contrast with Homer. In the Iliad, Helen is a tragic figure. She is beautiful, she is noble, and she is deeply disappointed. She has found Paris to be a tin god. Having run away with him and come back to Troy with him, she discovers that he's just a pretty face and no guts behind it. She is deeply sorry for the blood and destruction that she herself has caused. She is highly apologetic to Hector, whom she admires deeply, for defending his city. And she is deeply resentful at the goddess Aphrodite, the goddess of love, who has taken such a large hand in her life and ruined her life. She is a noble and tragic figure in Homer. Shakespeare makes her silly, mindless, a complete airhead. She's got one scene, 100 lines long, and she comes noodling on stage, necking with Paris. She asks for a song. Let thy song be love. This love will undo us all. That's the name of the song. But it's a terribly appropriate name, because it will undo all Troy. Let thy song be love, this love will undo us all. Oh, Cupid, Cupid, Cupid. Instead of the Homeric Helen's deep rage at Aphrodite and resentment, we get this blonde nitwit saying, oh, Cupid, Cupid, Cupid. Well, she gets the song she asks for. It goes like this, or part of it goes like this. These lovers cry, oh, oh, they die. Yet that which seems the wound to kill doth turn, oh, oh, to ha, ha, he. So dying love lives still. Oh, oh, a while, but ha, ha, ha. Oh, oh, groans out for ha, ha, ha. I am not making this up. This is the most ridiculous song in Shakespeare. We do not have the original music for it, but I cannot imagine any music that would make this song make any kind of sense. As the dialogue continues, Paris says of the singer of the song, he eats nothing but doves, love, and that breeds hot blood. And hot blood begets hot thoughts, and hot thoughts beget hot deeds, and hot deeds is love. That's what all this tragedy is about. Some people who eat doves and get highly worked up, sexually aroused, and hot deeds, that's love. The next speaker says, is this the generation of love? Is love a generation of vipers? Now, we're just left to gather that. There's no direct comment on them now. We just see this silly airhead. But there is a comment later on. It comes from Diomedes, the Greek hero, who is asked directly by Paris, who in your thought deserves Helen best? Myself, Paris, or Menelaus, her original husband. And Diomedes says, both alike. He merits well to have her that doth seek her, not making any scruple of her soil, with such a hell of pain and world of charge. He that has her is heavier for a whore. Paris objects, you are too bitter to your country, woman. And Diomedes says, she's bitter to her country. Hear me, Paris, for every false drop in her body veins, a Grecian's life hath sunk. For every scruple of her contaminated carrion weight, a Trojan hath been slain. Since she could speak, she hath not given so many good words breath as for her Greeks and Trojans suffered death.